This is for Clementine and Otis. So shout outs to the sponsors of the THT podcast, Indosol. You can get some slides or flip-flops made from repurposed motor vehicle tyres. Indosol are a B Corp certified company, which is the certification created by the brand Patagonia. And they have taken over 100,000 tyres out of landfill and repurposed them. Now, you can look good and do your part for the environment by becoming a conscious consumer. So get a pair at Indosol.com. That's Indosole.com and use code THT at checkout for a 15% discount. Delivery is fast and direct from the distributor in your region, and they are worldwide.
I'm having a good time.
You are?
Yeah.
I can tell.
And we are rolling too.
Terrible happy talks. Today's guest is Lige Saki. Lige is a husband, father, skateboarder, surfer, producer, and filmmaker. Lige is following his heart and living his dream. He resides in Venice, California, in pursuit of his next creative incarnation, whatever that may be. When you look at Lige's resume, it becomes immediately obvious that he's compelled to share stories that possess a deeply human aspect. A diverse array of portraits that includes skateboarding docuseries creations for the likes of legendary skateboarding culture influences, The Berricks, to most recently his work on full-length feature film, The Peanut Butter Falcon, which is a modern-day Mark Twain adventure-style story. And these are just to name just some of his work. So today, Lige is with me live from California to share his journey, experiences, challenges, and hopes for the future. Lige Saki, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thanks for being here, mate. Dude, a bit of internet issue. Doesn't happen often, but it got there in the end.
Do you like your first or second try?
That's my second take. And I'm going to be honest. I'm like, dude, this guy's a film producer. I just feel like such a rookie around you.
Oh, dude, no. Why? How? I didn't know how to do anything 10 years ago, you know? So,
has it been 10 years that you've been pursuing the film industry?
Probably more. I mean, I like to say I made my first movie. First real movie at around 30, and I'm 43 now. So 13 years, it's actually been a long time. Yeah. And that first movie, I had no, like I had acted before that, you know, so I had no behind the camera experience.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of filmmakers start out in acting. Was it because like you realized that acting was a very challenging thing to actually make something out of, and that's what led you to filmmaking, or was it more the creative aspect?
Yeah, well, I don't know, early on I acted because I wanted the attention from it, you know, honestly. Like, I don't think I cared. I didn't have I want to be the best actor there is out there, or I didn't have these ambitions. I didn't go to high school to, you know, do that. I wasn't in college for that. Like, it just kind of fell into my lap when I was in San Diego after, you know, I was going to grad school down there. And, but I also like really kind of screwed it up quite a bit by, you know, using alcohol and kind of fucking off for my 20s. And I wasn't really prepared for a lot of opportunities I got. So it was hard. You know, I think you have to work really hard as an actor to have success. And I kind of half-assed it. And what got me into the movie making side of things was I just didn't want to wait for a job anymore. You know, I didn't want somebody to have to say yes. So I said, well, let's make our own thing here. And I got some friends together from a class I was in. And, you know, my dad helped me. He's a writer. He's still a writer. He's like a published poet, a short story writer, and never wrote a script before. But I was like, Dad, will you write something? And he wrote something based off me and some friends getting together and recording ourselves for like a year. And he picked four people and wrote this road trip story. And then I ended up the first 10 minutes of the movie takes place in LA. So I was like, I'll shoot that. We'll use that to raise some money for the whole thing. And I did, I produced that, but I was in it, you know, I produced this thing. I had a friend direct it. And, but after making that, you know, we had this little theater where all these people came, all the local, I still live in the same place I live at now when we did this, you know, and it's this little neighborhood viewing spot. And these people showed up and it was really cool. But like after that, I just had the urge to want to like make something else, not necessarily be in anything. Like I wanted to produce stuff. My father ended up writing this other script behind the scenes about these. It's like an amped up My Dinner with Andre, two guys talking over lunch, sex, religion, life on other planets, Hitler, Samuel Beckett, da 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 da. And I was like, I'm going to produce this to show people I can produce something, you know, and I ended up directing that movie. And that was that thing I did when I was 30. And we did this movie in like 4.5 days at this, you know, closed down restaurant. And I remember driving home going, this is what I want to do. Like in my car, just having that thought where I was like, God, this is what I really want to do. Like, I really like this. Like it felt good. So
did you get a feeling of like, I'm creating a legacy?
No.
No.
I just was fulfilled. Like, I just felt like I was doing something that meant something for the first time, you know?
In what way? What did it mean? Like, what was it? What was it making you? Meant something in what way? Like, you were...
Not for anyone else, but I felt, like, accomplished. Like, I had done something that I was proud of, gotcha. You know, that felt like... I also felt like I was okay at it, you know? Like, I did a good job. I felt like I did a good job. And I had never directed a movie before, you know? I had barely known how to produce anything before that. But I read a book. I read this book called Shot by Shot or Shot for Shot. I can't remember. And I was just like, what are things called? You know? And it was so weird, but I was really comfortable up there doing it. And I was really comfortable talking to the actors because I had acted and I understood that side of things the best that I thought I could. And I feel like if there's one thing I'm okay at, it's like judging a performance for being authentic or not, you know, like being able to see if somebody's being real. So that felt like that's all I did was try to make sure people felt real. Like the DP did the DP stuff and you know, everybody did their stuff that I didn't know how to do. And I don't know. I just felt really good. Like I wanted to learn more. I wanted to do more. And I wanted to like, just try to make more stuff.
So you were working
now, like, well, I mean, I don't think any of it, like if I look back now, do I still think it was good or do I no, but like I felt good, you know? Yeah. So
you were working on that intuitive sense? Yeah.
Yeah. I think so, yeah.
A guy said to me once, he said in life, Shannon, you know, move towards the energy and that's what will propel you forward. And I love it because it's an analogy that I link to surfing. Like, when you want to propel yourself down the wave, you turn back towards the energy. So would it be safe to say that you just felt like a really good energy from doing that, more so than being an actor?
100%. And there's a collaboration, there's working with other people, and, you know, it was like a whole team effort. Yeah, it felt good. And I always thought that I was like math and science brained, you know. Really? I was really good at, yeah, like when in high school I was in honors classes in math and science. I didn't have to try. Like that stuff all came really easy. And I always said I'm not good at reading. And I mean, I could read. I'm very like I'm very educated in that sense, but I wasn't like the writer. I wasn't writing short stories. I wasn't that. I had a story about myself that wasn't me, you know. My father's very creative. My sister's very creative, and I just acted like I wasn't creative. I was like a math and science guy. I went to grad school to get an MBA, you know, business degree. And it just was not like what I do now. Like that's all very helpful for what I do now in a way. But I had this story that I wasn't any of those things. And then to get to do those things later, because no one was telling me that there was this opportunity to go direct a movie or even be an actor. Like I didn't have that. Like where I came from, it was either be a lawyer, like an engineer or a doctor to get the fuck out of where you're from. All I wanted to do was get out. You know, how do I get out? Be a successful rich person. How do you do that? You go to college and you're one of these three things. And it just put me down a path that I didn't know the other paths existed. My parents weren't telling me you can do this, this, and that. I just didn't have that childhood. You know, it was a survival.
Survival instinct. Okay. So where did you grow up then? Where was it that you wanted to get out of?
I grew up in a bunch of spots. My parents moved around early on and they split up and I went back and forth between the two. But this place that I talk about, what I refer to was Northern Michigan. East Side, which is this small, really, I'd speak nicely about it, a town called Tawa City. It's on Lake Huron. It's on the east side, north of Detroit. Real small, real, make up your own words, you know?
Yeah.
Like middle America feeling, which is, you know, not a bad, but it also doesn't make you feel like this place you want to stay, for me at least. And then I went to live with my father in Kentucky for a little while. And then I ended up moving back in with my mom up in Traverse City, Michigan, which is on the west side of Michigan. Beautiful spot. That's where I spent my middle school and high school years. So that's when I say I'm from Michigan. That's I refer to those years because that's where I did the most, I think, growing as a person.
Yeah, well, yeah,
that's when I got into skateboarding, and that's when my life excelled and it felt fun. And before that, I felt like my life sucked. It was pretty shitty.
It's so interesting to me because so many skateboarders seem to come from broken homes. My parents divorced when I was 12 years old. Do you mind if I ask how old you were when your parents separated?
Yeah, my parents separated when I was, I think I was 3 or 4. I was young. And then they remarried.
Oh, wow.
My mom remarried a few times to people that I did not like every time.
Okay.
My father remarried, and I did not like my stepmom. I love her now, but at those times, I just hated everyone that came in. I hated everything about it. Like, I hated the new brothers and sisters. I was a really lonely kid at those times, and I sought attention. I wasn't getting it, So when I had a chance to, reinvent myself when I moved in with my mother in Michigan, I was like, who, I sought, like, the, back then, you're the same age as me, is like the skateboarders were all outsiders, They were all the guys that cops didn't like you. No one liked you. Like, it's so different now. It's a much different thing. Like, the skateboarders are the cool kids. They weren't, like, it wasn't that. It was cool to me, but most people thought you were somewhat of a loser or something, But that's who I was attracted to. And I think it's because I was in this defiance mode,
You've kind of answered it. I am curious to hear what the impact on you was. You were 3 or 4. That's quite young. But I guess as the years progressed, would you say that it actually got harder, being from a broken home?
I had this story that's why I was going to prove everyone wrong. And it was going to that's what was going to drive me this whole time. That it's like, my parents did this to me. They made me, this way. And that was like, I was going to show the world, like, that's what gave me drive, but it was all the wrong sort of drive. I think it worked early on, 'cause I was going to prove everyone wrong, but not that anybody really even cared, it was just like, who am I proving wrong? But that's just like this thing that I lived by. It just was that whole rebellious thing that we all, like, all of my friends that were skaters too, they all came from broken homes, like you said, but we created a family for ourselves, and that's what worked. And that got me through high school, and then I went off to college and created a new family with new people. And I just kept creating these little families that were, I think, early on authentic, and then later on they were just alcohol, helped. They weren't real.
Yeah.
So
it's a big,
I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it does. And I hope you don't mind me sort of delving into a little bit, because now that you're at the other end of it, like, you're in your 40s and you reflect upon it, do you feel a closeness to your family?
I do.
You do?
I do.
And have you reconnected in that aspect?
Yeah. I've been pretty close with them for a while now. And a lot of it came from being an alcoholic and going through, I'm in a program and I've been sober for 8 years. And I, that there's work that you do in that program where you have, you come clean for a lot of things. And you also let go of a lot of these stories that I, you know, my parents didn't have a guidebook on how to raise me. You know, they did the best they could. You know, they were all, in, everybody was in survival mode. So
would you say you used that situation as an excuse for your drinking for many years?
Maybe. I think I probably did. I don't know if I feel that way today. Because, you know, my dad got sober when I was young.
So
he was in the room. He was in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, okay. You know, when I was in the Kentucky, like, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old. So I knew it was there. I just avoided it for so long because I was terrified of trying to get through life without alcohol. You know,
why?
It was scary.
Why?
Because everything I learned to do early on in my life, I drank through. Like, as soon as I started skating, and as soon as we started hanging out and having drinks, and like, I use drinks to meet girls, I use drinks to talk to people, I use drinks to get through jobs and work and any bit of life skills. Like, I was a scared kid. So if I had to do anything that was scary, I drank for it, you know? So when I finally wanted to hang up the drinking portion of my life, I was terrified of life, you know? So.
Do you mind if I ask how low it took you? Where did it take
you? How low?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I got sober when I was 30, around when I made that first movie the first time, and I didn't stay sober. But I think it was lower then than it got later, you know? I just came back to it and, again, wasn't quite ready yet, I don't think. I was too smart still. I was too special still, you know? I still...
Different?
I always thought I was smarter than everyone else, different. Man. All that, like, early on. Yeah, it's different, unique, all this. And I held on to that still till I was, like, you know, I was with a girl who has a son, was my wife now, you know? She had a 2-year-old when we met, and he was 4. And I just was, like, not a good dude as far as, like, I was a liability, you know? And one day she was like, you need to stop or we're done. And I was so ready for somebody to tell me that. So I did. I hung it up the next day and I knew where to go because I'd already done 1.5 years of, you know, being sober and knowing the path I could go on. But I, at that time, that this time through, which is, I'm still sober today from that moment.
Congratulations.
It's like, I thank you. Yeah. It's, I knew it was time. Like I just felt it that time. I didn't go into the program again being special or smart or anything. I was like, I'm dumb. I don't know shit. I'm here to listen. Tell me how to do this, you know?
So you were surrendered.
Totally. But the worst it got was way worse before that. Like there were so many moments I should not have made it out, you know? Like it's just like, how the fuck would I get? I wake up and see if my car was in the driveway, you know, and have flashback memories of car spinning out on the freeway and, you know, it just, yeah.
I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit.
Sure.
And how would you define the term sobriety? Now, the obvious one is it's the absence of substances, you know, alcohol or drugs. But would you have a different perspective on the term sobriety? Because I know I do, but I'd like to hear what your idea is on it.
Yeah, it's funny because I'm putting this other movie together that I wrote about a guy that burns his life down and ends up in a sober living. And it has this whole cast full of, I've got attached all these actors that are actually sober, but they all have different meanings of sobriety. Like some of them are, you know, programmed, some are just haven't smoked weed or don't drink or still smoke weed, but don't drink or, you know, all that. For me, it's just, not taking anything, it affects you from the neck up. But also, like, it's really hard to be sober without some kind of program because...
Why?
And that's just dry. Like, I have to have... Like, this whole spiritual thing is what's really helped me. It's just knowing that I'm not in control of anything, you know?
Yeah.
Or not in control of anything, really, except my own actions. And sometimes I'm not even in control of that, you know? So...
Yeah, the reason I sort of wanted to touch on it is because... I'm 8 years sober myself. And what I find challenging is when the same or similar behavior patterns and actions are still present when there's an absence of alcohol and drugs, and you're still behaving in similar ways. And is that, are you sober then if you're still doing the same things, you know what I mean? And I think, I guess in my journey so far, I mean, that's been the hardest thing. And I think the thing that actually keeps me on track is what, like what you said, is that, that connection to, you know, a higher power of your own understanding. I mean, without that, it's not just not drinking. It's also like clean thinking, you know, you know, developing a set of values that are in line with how you want to be in the future. That's what I find hard personally.
Yeah, I mean, I say this a lot when I'm asked to share at a meeting or something. As like, I'm currently trying to put in my 10,000 hours into being sober, and of the mind, of the behaving, because all the stuff that I ended up with when I was 30 and 35 and 40, it's all stuff that I learned as a kid that worked as a kid. Like the showing off, the being in the center of attention, the reacting, the, you know, manipulating, all that stuff worked really well. So it's all super unconscious behavior for me as an adult. And the only way to unlearn that stuff is practice. This, you know, you have to put 10,000 hours into something to be perfect or to be a pro. And I'm trying to put 10,000 hours into AA or sobriety or whatever you want to call it, because I have to undo all that other shit that just is so natural, right? Like it's the, I don't feel right, I want to yell at somebody. I want, you know, like that, until it become the, until the natural thought is to, oh, just let the car in. You know, that's not the natural thought, but I think you, it takes time. I'm doing the math. I have to do 40 years of this before I start to do the other stuff perfect. So,
I mean, that when I hear
a lot of work ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's true. It is. When I heard that saying that, like, you stop growing emotionally after your first drink. That scared me, man. I was like, well, really? I had my first drink when I was 12. Yeah. So, yeah, like I've got a lot of developing and growing and work to do as well. And it can seem really daunting. What would you say to someone who's in that predicament of, you know, embarking on a similar journey?
That's having a hard time acting like a child still.
Acting like a child.
No, I mean, that's what I say. We're living on like childhood survival skills. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's true. That's how I
it is.
I still feel that way. It's like fight or flight, you know?
Yeah. And you know what? Can I jump in there, Lige? Sorry. And it actually, like I said, it was a survival mechanism that worked when you were 12 or 15 or whatever. But I guess what I've learned is that when you try to do that as an adult, it's just like, it doesn't work when you're an adult. And in fact, it's like, you become like a crazy, people are just like, that guy's got issues. Like, let's stay as far away from him as possible. And that can be really isolating, but it's just so profound, the experiences that you have as a kid and how much we carry them. And I don't know about you, but I personally look around the world and the people that I'm in contact with that aren't necessarily like alcoholics or addicts, but I see the behavior patterns, and they're manifesting it through, you know, use of technology is a really obvious one, shopping, sex, working too much. I don't know. Just an observation.
Yeah. I mean, you say, I don't want to be too like programmy at all, but like I can do everything alcoholically, you know, like I surf alcohol, like I surf obsessively, you know, like I on my skate. Yeah. I just want to do more of whatever it is. I eat this ice cream called Not a Moo. Like every night I eat the same, like it's, I just do everything to the fullest because that's what I did early on. I don't know. Or like when I drink, I cannot stop. Right. And that stuff applies to like a lot of different things, you know, I think it's just an addictive personality maybe, but I think I'm more addicted to the healthy stuff these days, which is good. And, better than not, I guess.
Would you say it's been a double-edged sword because like that same approach has helped you in life as well? Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. Like my work ethic and all that stuff is, you know, I think about my wife, and I know she's gotten upset sometimes when it's like, you want to go this and you got to do this for Lige and this for Lige. And it's because it makes me feel good. So I do things excessively that make me feel good, right? Whether now it's healthy stuff, before it was drinking, because that made me feel good until it didn't. And I guess it can be just like, it's still fulfilling this Lige need, you know, like, how do I feel better instead of like trying to help other people feel better?
Are you feeling bad deep down?
No. Okay. No. I just, but being aware about that, you know, being aware of that when it comes in and being able to like, okay, pump the brakes, be present for your family today, you know, help somebody else, take your kid out and not take them for a hike and not look at your watch because it's time to go, you know, be present. Just be present.
And do you
slow down?
Do you find your family has provided a balancing counterpoint for you? Is that what 100%. Is that what brings you down to earth the most?
Yeah. Family program. Just being older now, you know, not caring about any of the other shit I used to care about so much. Really, like I seek such a simple type of a life, you know.
Really?
Or I enjoy being in a, yeah, I know, totally.
I'm going to challenge that. I mean, because.
Smaller, like more, I don't know. Like, it's not so.
I mean,
challenge it.
Because you're like.
What do you mean?
Well, I'm challenging it because, like, a simple life, I don't see making films and producing films in the Hollywood space as simple. It seems like it would be very challenging. You'd be coming up against a lot of big personalities, varying time schedules. I'm assuming that you have to manage budget, things like that. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's complicated, but that's not, I guess, not what I mean by simple. Simple is like, you know, I've got a handful of friends, not 40. You know, I spend the weekends with my family. Like, you know what I mean by,
gotcha.
I surf, I skate, I stay in my little zone here where I live. I'm not out at this okay. restaurant or that one. I just keep it small. Okay. But no, the job I do is very challenging. It's hard, but you know, I think it's still keeping my bubble simple, you know, as simple as I can.
Is your job sustaining you and your family quite adequately, if you don't mind me asking? Because I hear a lot of people, I mean, what you're doing is challenging. You hear about people who are, you know, actors waiting tables and, you know, and the work can come and go. Are you in a place in your life where it is sustainable?
It's sustainable, yeah. I mean, some people think I'm rich, and that's just, I'm rich in my life, but I'm not financially rich. So, by any means, it's a tough balance because you want to make more money, but to do certain things to make more money, you're giving up more time with your family and you're giving up more time for plague. And I just, the older I get, the more I want to play, you know, the more I want to enjoy it. Cause it's just, you only get one time around the, you know, this whole thing. So, but to answer your question, it's hard, but like you play for the big wins, you know. Peanut Butter Falcon was a big win. I'm not saying that made anybody rich, but like you take big swings and and I also produce commercials. So that's like a way that keeps me able to spend time developing a movie or a show for several years, you know?
So are you doing a combination of like, you know, things to pay the bills, like commercials and then passion projects?
Yeah, I mean, they're all in the hopes to pay the bills. Like every single one of them has a financial, I don't really do many things for free anymore unless it's just for myself. I want to make this little thing and I'll just do that for free. But like, they're all, you know, you want to make money on them all. So they all have potential to make money. It's just commercial production it's just more instant. It's short lived, you know, you go do a job for a couple of weeks and you're home and it's done. Like you live with these movies forever. Mm. So.
How long do you think it took you to get to that space where people are sourcing you out for that kind of work and the work starts to flow? Like, especially for someone that wants to embark on it themselves.
How long did it take me to get to
the place you're in right now, where work is flowing?
11 years.
11 years. Wow.
Yeah.
That's sacrifice.
I always like had side hustles, you know?
Yeah.
But now I don't feel like I have a side hustle. I feel like I'm comfortably in it, but not, it still can be scary because I don't know. Producers somehow feel like they get left behind a lot, but that's okay.
What do you mean?
I'm accepting.
What do you mean they get left behind a lot?
I just, they're always asked to defer their money to the end. You know, not always, but like indie film producers. You know, I don't know. It's like you get a salary that it's over a 5-year span. Like it just doesn't add up. You know, it's just. And I'm not complaining. I'm very grateful. I like it. It's a selfless job, and that's took a while to figure out. But I really enjoy that because it's kind of like you know, another form of being of service to something that's not about me. You know.
Gotcha.
But indie producing is not a super lucrative space financially.
Would you do
many things?
I mean, is Peanut Butter Falcon an indie movie? Is that described as an indie movie? So, can you like? I mean, I watched the trailer. It looks like such a beautiful movie. Like, how did it come about? Like, how did you get involved with that from the ground up?
The semi-short version of it is I had made a short film that I just made on my own on the side for fun.
What was it? You know, what was that one called? Was it Belong?
It's called Belong. Yeah. About a skateboard kid that gets bullied like in downtown LA and goes off and does this little thing and creates his own space. And, you know, I don't know. It got a lot of play. It actually, you know, it got me the big skateboarding documentary job. And it sent me to this festival in North Carolina where I met Mike and Tyler, who wrote Peanut Butter Falcon. They also had a short film there, and we met the first day there. We hit it off, and we just like hung out for 7 days. It's a short film festival, or it's a film festival that flew and put up people that make short films.
Keep going. Yeah, just I was rubbing against your jumper. Sorry to cut you off.
Should I put my ear pods in?
No, this is great. It's great. You sound great. I'm very conscious of it. You probably can't hear it now, but then in the post production, I'll hear it like scraping. So sorry, keep going. Yeah. So you met the writers of the movie.
I met these guys. I met these guys in North Carolina, and we hit it off. This festival, it flew you out there and put you up at these hotels for a short film, which is just like unheard of. Really cool festival called Kookaloris. And we just went there, milked it and hung out, hit it off. I'd been making these low budget movies. You know, I probably made 10 movies before I made Peanut Butter Falcon.
Amazing.
All kind of under $500,000 each one. And they're like, we're going to do this. We're going to do this. You know, we'll make it for cheap, you're going to produce it with us, for us, whatever. And then I came back home after that festival, and I went off to do the Push documentary. When I came back from that, they had went off to North Carolina with another producer, Dave Thies, who helped them shoot this proof of concept for it with the real Zach who's in the movie, and Tyler played the Tyler character. And they shot the raft, and they shot some scenes from the script. And when I had gotten back, we started taking that out to different places and got some different people. That was kind of like what kicked it off. Without that proof of concept, it would have been a different road. And that thing, it was so good, and people just really loved it and gravitated towards it. And then actors were reading the script, and they were loving it. And it just took on this like whole life of its own. So,
like, what attracted you to it originally, like, in terms of the story?
The guys, Mike and Tyler, first of all.
Okay.
Just because we vibe. And all I want to do is make things with my friends. Like, that's what I want to do today. Like, I guess that's what I've learned over the years. All I want to do is make cool shit with my friends. Whether that's bigger stuff, you know, like, you start to meet bigger and more successful friends, or your friends become bigger and more successful. And that's all. Then it becomes a business that you can live off of, you know. But what attracted me was them. And then, you know, this Zach, of course, who's, you know, this beautiful person who Zach has Down syndrome, and he plays the lead himself. And the story behind it, and it's just a great story. It's the story makes you feel good. It's got hope, you know, and that was just something that I was always attracted to this dark shit, like I really like all childhood kids type stuff, like just fucked up dark stuff. Like I always wanted to tell those stories. And then this popped in and I was like, oh, it fully changed the way I want to do stuff and what I want to focus on. Because that one thing that movie did last year, it just came, like it just made people feel good. I think that's why it was well received, you know. You walked out of there going, oh man, this is, you know.
Dude,
I think that kind of has an effect on everything I'm doing right now. I want to feel good. I think everyone wants to feel good. It's been a fucking wild year, you know.
So, it has been a wild year. Do you think that's a manifestation of how you've changed as a person?
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. I try to walk on the sunny side of the street, you know. I focus on the stuff that works in my life, not the stuff that doesn't.
That's right.
It's really just change. Yeah, fully.
I don't know.
It sounds foo-foo-y, but
no, it like doesn't.
I
can tell.
It's getting older, and yeah.
I can tell.
I wake up happy, you know. I want to hang out with happy people, like. I don't know.
That's nice, man. Just to go back a little bit, you mentioned something earlier, like we do have such a finite time on this planet. And I think a lot about the concept of time and how precious it is. I don't know if that's a product of me getting older, being in my 40s and stuff, but they say that you're a product of the five closest people around you. And I take that concept more and more seriously these days because, like, you know, who am I spending my time with, you know? Like, and again, I'm spending that time and I think about that. So I fully agree with you, bro.
Yeah.
Now I want to hit you up a little bit. You said that you made the push docuseries season one for The Berricks. So for those that don't know, The Berricks was created by legendary skateboarders Steve Berra and Eric Costin. And if anyone knows anything about skateboarding, like those guys, man, they're just the guys. They really are. How did you get involved with The Berricks originally?
Well, that short film that I made Berricks ended up playing it, putting it on their, you know, website.
Amazing.
It got a little hype. Like, well, Odd Future, Left Brain from Odd Future did the score, which helped excise nobody cares what I was doing at the time, but they, you know, it was on, they put it on their page, but I got a Vimeo staff pick out of it before Vimeo staff picks were given out all the time, you know? So back then you got one and you'd have it, just your shit rocketed, you know? So got a staff pick and, you know, Hypebeast played it, I think, and just all these different outlets picked it up. Transworld, when it was Transworld, was around and Berricks played it. I was like, oh, sick, you know? And then I think Barra hit me up or somebody connected me. I think Mike Falco maybe connected me.
Okay.
With I don't know. You wouldn't know him, but I just was thinking of, I should say his name. He connected. Somehow got connected, and then we went down. I met up with him, and we talked about doing some like short projects, some commercial type stuff, and like we had some ideas. And Bear had some stuff going on, and then he hit me one day. He's like, "I have this thing. I think I want you to work on it with me. And it's this push thing. And would you produce it?" I was like, "Fuck yeah!" So we did it with this small team. It's crazy what we pulled off, but like Hansu and O'Neill and a couple guys shot it, a couple guys edited it, but we did 48 episodes, you know.
What?
And yeah,
what were your standout?
We traveled to Brazil and Portugal and China. It was just, it was so insane. It was blew my mind. Like I was in a kid in a candy store because these were all my idols. And all these new kids that I didn't know that well because I, you know, retired, semi-retired for half of my life. And then I came back and it was incredible. It was like, it was a full dream come true, you know, like that was like, okay, to start where I started and to end up doing that, I felt like I had made it, you know, like that was enough for me. So. No, really. It was like all the things I really loved in my life as a kid, it all came true right here, you know? And then I was making movies. We had a full length documentary that never, unfortunately, would see the light of day because the deal with NBC, they were going to take, you know, I don't really know what happened with it, but we premiered it at the Ace Theater in LA And it was so great. I just remember being so, like, it gave you a look into skateboarding on, like, what these guys are all about, like, what it takes and where they come from, you know, the human story of it, which I hadn't seen much of that in skateboarding. It was all like trick, video part, trick, you know, like, not like I brought some friends that didn't really understand skateboarding, and they, you know, some of my wife's friends and these women were like, oh my God, I get it now. Like, that's hard, you know, and just in where these kids came from, and Ishad and Luan and just, you know, Leticia, and there's so many different walks of life. It was really, really cool.
What was the time frame that you produced those and recorded those? Was it over the course of a year or?
Yeah, December. I started in I remember December because it was around Christmas. We went to Detroit for Cody's part.
Cody McIntyre?
No, Cody Cepeda.
Oh, Cody Cepeda, yeah.
Yeah.
He won the Barracks.
He won the Barracks,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it was snowing. It was freezing. And I'm from Michigan, so we started in Detroit. I was so psyched. and then we premiered that full length in August. And it was right after that I went into Peanut Butter Falcons. So
amazing, dude.
It was a crazy year. Yeah, it was so nice.
See, skateboarding launches another career. Yeah. I mean,
I think that was the first time I was able to like pay my bills, and like I was making decent money doing that. And like,
amazing.
That's kind of where it changed, you know, really.
It's kind of like
where I didn't do the other stuff anymore, you know.
It's kind of like a Spike Jonze-esque journey, you know. Is Spike Jonze like someone you really look up to?
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah.
He's the man.
He's the man.
I love skateboarders that work in other stuff, you know?
Like, yeah.
There's this work. I think he said it, or Harmony said it. It's like we're so used to trying the same trick for days and days and days that, like, no job is hard. You know, you just do it. You do it and you do it and you do it and you never give up, you know, because you're used to that struggle to make that trick. And that's the thing. Like, if I ever can hire a skateboarder to do any job, I do, because, you know, they have most of the time have that drive to like get it done. You know,
years and years ago, back in the 90s, there was a Canadian skateboarder I really admired, Moses Akonin. He used to skate for DC. He was friends with Colin McKay. And in an interview once he said, you know, skateboarding's just taught me so much about life. It's just taught me to fall down and get back up again. And it really does. Like, and I think for me, if I didn't have a skateboarding foundation, I think life would have beat me down a long time ago, you know. But it does. It's just like, oh, you fall down, you get back up. You keep going. But just hearing those stories about some of the skaters that you've worked with, I mean, was there a standout episode that really, really sort of got to you?
I mean, when we went to Brazil for Luan and Leticia's part, and that was really like, you know, this was Barris' thing, and it was his, like, you know, it was his baby, but he didn't get to make it to the Brazil part. And I got to interview Luan for those first couple episodes. And it was like, that was a big deal for me. I just, you know, it was just really cool. And it was so emotional and where he came from and just seeing those spots. That the Brazil stuff was gnarly, but it was amazing too. You know, we would skate these spots and Red gave us all this gear, right? So we have all these,
like, red cameras,
red camera. Like, we had two or three cameras, just all these, just the best gear. And amazing. We're in Brazil where they're like, oh, get back in the car, time to go, because we'll get robbed. Yeah. You know, it was sketchy, so sketchy. And like, and there's like five, no security, nothing. It was just like what we pulled off and just the experience in itself, and how good Luan is at skateboarding.
Oh my
too.
God,
like,
dude.
The dude, yeah, it's insane how good he is in real life. Like, how consistent, and it just mind blowing. And then to get to talk to him, and I was so nervous to do that thing, you know, because it's just, I look up to these skateboarders more than I look up to any type of profession. Really
nervous, you know? About the interviewing aspect of it.
Yeah. Just like the worthy, like, can I do this kind of thing? And it wasn't like, it's just weird, you know, like what I put on my idea of a pro skateboarder compared to any other career is like, you know, I just think the world of it. I know how hard it is. And I just really like admire those guys and look up to them. And I know, like, I don't know what it takes because I didn't get to that level, but like, just even skateboarding the way that I did, it's just like a thing that I'm so like, I care so much about it. Like I didn't want to fuck it up, you know?
Yeah.
But not even about me so much as like, I wanted to be able to have this project be good, you know?
Yeah.
So
how do you manage self-doubt in those situations? Cause you sort of just mentioned then that you said like, I was interviewing Luan and I was sort of asking, I was nervous because am I worthy of doing this? Like,
I was nervous before. Once we started, I wasn't nervous. It was all good. I talk to people. Like, one thing I have learned, and I think, you know, sobriety and my program has taught me, like, ask when you don't know shit. Ask when you're feeling like less than, you know, ask for help, like tell somebody, talk you off the ledge, you know? So I call people, like, I don't sit and try to sit with it myself. Like, or I talk to people that have done it before that know more than me. And before I was so like, I felt like I had, before I got to this stage in my life, I always thought I had to act like I knew everything. It was always putting on a show. This was this whole kid-like thing going on forever where I had to be the smartest and the craftiest and the whatever person in the room or no one was going to like me. And then when I realized I could just be dumb, not dumb, but like I could be the guy that doesn't know everything and I can ask for help, life got a lot easier, you know? So I tend to ask for help. I will ask a lot of people for help, you know? I don't care. The ego hopefully is beaten down a little bit.
I was going to say, you know? is it the shedding, the ego is being shed?
Try, yeah. Still there. You
know? It is there. But, I mean, especially in the industry you work in, I mean, you must come up against some pretty big egos from time to time and some quite like strong characters, especially when you're going through creative processes. You know, how are you managing those people in those scenarios? How do you approach them?
I don't think you can manage them, but I can only manage my reaction to them. No, that's what I said earlier
answer.
When I said
textbook answer.
I want to work with my friends.
Yeah,
you know,
goes back to
so
that.
You try to see the red flags early on and just not do the stuff. But you know, you're always going to get into a place where somebody, you know, it's not the best to work with, or it's just a, you know, bump on a log. Like it's, you can't do anything. You can't make it. It's never going to be perfect. So it's just how I react to it really.
Yeah.
And I try to, you know, like I said, walk on the sunny side of the street, go over here, if they're over there. And,
so you're a lot more selective with who you work with.
I try to be. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right now I feel like I can be, you know, early on I said yes to everything because I wanted to make stuff and I wanted to gain experience. And I had some miserable experiences. I had, you know, I made one movie where I was like, I'm never doing this again. This is terrible. This is the worst. And then I met this new director writer who wanted to make something so tiny and small that was so going to be so hard. And he was the best person to work with ever. And he like reinvigorated this whole love I have for it. So I think it's a lot of who you surround yourself with, you know, because it's already hard. Like, why want to do this with difficult people too? Never, you know, not anymore.
What if the money's there?
I don't think the money's worth the misery, you know? I don't anymore. Because it's no, like, I stopped caring. Money's, like, I have more money today than I had 8 months ago. I don't feel any better about it, you know? No better. It does not change. I know that it doesn't. Even if I was having this conversation with another sober buddy of mine yesterday. He's like, if somebody gave me $10 million and just said, you can't work, you just have to enjoy the money. And he was like, would you do it? And I said, I don't know. Would you do it? He's like, fuck no, I couldn't do it. Like, what am I supposed to do? I would be so wrapped up in my own shit all the time. You're not able to go make stuff anymore. You can't go direct and write a movie. You can't do that if you get the $10 million. You just have to go like surf and have fun with your family. I was like, I don't know if I would be fulfilled. Like, I have to want to do stuff like that fulfills me in that sense, you know? So I don't know. It's a tough question to answer, but the money's not changing me like I thought it would.
It's not, but it,
but I don't have a, but I don't have a lot of it either. So I don't know, well, but I don't think so.
I guess what I'm getting at a little bit is how much is it guiding your decisions?
If it was guiding my decisions, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. Because it's not lucrative enough to be guiding me anywhere, you know? So it's clearly not a money thing. It's clearly a love for work. Like, what was that? What's that saying? If you love what you do, you never work a day in your life. And that's how I feel. Sometimes it feels like work, but like really, like I do, I don't have to do anything today, but I will do work because I enjoy it, you know?
Dude.
So.
Dude, it's so funny. Yeah, the money thing, just to go on a little bit about it, I find for me personally, the less I care about money, the more it seems to flow. I mean, not to say I have a lot of money at all, but it's just bizarre. But when my focus is money and I'm striving for it and I'm like scratching for it, it seems less like it seems less attainable. But I guess when my focus is on things that align with my core values, fulfillment is the word you used, that comes into play more, you know. And I don't know about you, but when you've come from a place of scarcity and not having a lot, it can be such a powerful driver. And I know for me, it's taken years to shed that, you know, and then it links very closely into like worthlessness as well. Like I'm not worth this and I'm not worth that. But I guess it's a work in progress.
Yeah. I've always been super grateful that I came from the place I came from, because my appreciation for, I think, smaller stuff, whatever people might call smaller or cheaper stuff, is like, I don't care about that. You know, like, of course we want a little more space, you know, you got more kids you need, you know, but like, you know, definitely don't care about some of the things that people I know care about, you know?
It's true, man. It's a funny balance. It's a really funny balance. It's funny, like the people I know that are quite wealthy, it's a burden. It's a burden for them in a lot of ways, you know? It's something that they have to manage, and it actually causes a lot of suffering for them. Which was a real eye opener for me, because again, coming from I think a similar space as you as a child, I thought that it's the problem solver. It's the ultimate problem solver. It's going to solve all my problems. I'll have no more worries. But I've now witnessed that it's actually the opposite. You know, and striving for fulfillment, I think, is much more sustainable. No, I see,
like going from whatever low income to middle, you realize like how much more shit you have to pay for, like how much more stuff. It's like literally more money, more problems is so like, it's so true. And if somebody that doesn't have any money is going to think you're an idiot for saying some of the, or like I sound like an idiot or an asshole, but it's like, it really is. It's
yeah. We could be accused. We could be accused of like, oh, that's a privileged thing to say. You know, but I mean,
I've been in a place with no money, so I don't know how privileged it is, right?
Yeah,
like
right.
It wasn't.
Look, it's been epic, you know, it's been almost an hour and, you know, I know you're on a tight schedule and, I've really just appreciated your time and I love that you've got a soda stream. You just had a drink.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Man,
I got all these drinks. I got my coffee.
Dude, you're organized. Actually, I recently just got a soda stream, and it's changed my life. I can't believe I didn't do it years ago. Anyway,
so good.
It's so good.
It was the worst, and my wife goes and still buys fucking LaCroix and Spindrift and all these drinks, and I'm like, we have a soda stream.
Just makes water fun, man, you know?
I love it.
Yeah, I mean, so they just had a bit of a toilet break, but I don't know. We're talking about money and all that sort of stuff and fulfillment, and I think for me, like, listening to you speak, like, it's obvious that, you know, you're just driven by this creative passion, which is really cool. And speaking of creative passion, like I do want to talk a little bit about the Peanut Butter Falcon movie, because like I haven't actually watched it, but I watched the trailer and I've heard a lot about it. What's the goal for you being involved in a movie like that? Is it obviously to have it seen by as many people as possible? And where are you up to with that movie's journey from a production point of view?
Well, it definitely exceeded any goal that any of us had, I think. For me especially, you know, the movie went on to, first of all, it was the hardest movie ever.
Why?
To make. It just, the production itself was hard. We fought a lot of things, like getting it made, between storm and schedule and money and all those things. It was a battle, you know, but we were watching clips of it at night. Like one of the, Mike can edit out of the two directors, and he would put together scenes at night and we would watch them like, oh my God, this is really good. Like we knew we had something early on. We would send them off to some of the people that helped, you know, finance it. And they were like, oh, we all knew. So we were in it, but it didn't change the fact that it was hard. But there's something about it when it's hard and it's working, it's okay. You know, the challenge feels fuck it. I'll do whatever it takes because it's working, you know?
Yeah.
And then we finished, we got denied from Sundance twice. We got denied from Toronto. We got denied from a lot of the big Toronto Film Festival,
Sundance Film Festival.
Yeah. Which is great. Like, it seems like such a shoo-in for those places, and just shows I don't know anything, or, you know, there's different reasons and certain social, political, whatever they were at the time. It's not my place to even bring them up, but South by Southwest gave us a shot, you know, and we went there and it played really well there. Won the audience award. They added all these extra screenings. And this is what we all thought, you know, we thought people would love this movie. We had done test audiences and it seemed to play really well. And no one wanted to buy it. No one wanted to buy it from us. So like with the biggest offer wouldn't have even got back a third of the budget, you know? So the financiers, who we could never thank enough, you know, Armory, Tim and Chris, they decided to put the money up for the P&A, and it's, you know, can be $10 to $20 million, and just to put that up and see what happens at the movie theaters. And we played, we released, we had a plan, we had some pros that got hired as consultants, and it worked. Like it worked. It, like, we started at four cities and we did, I think it was Austin, Salt Lake City. Salt Lake City was like the best city as far as how it performed
in Utah.
The whole cycle. Yeah.
Why? Like,
it just, the per screen average there was, it just killed everything out. I don't know. It played really well in the South and Middle America, and it didn't play as well in LA and New York and the big cities. I just think people really were drawn to it in those places. Super wild. And it did $20 million at the box office. And for an independent film like that, this just doesn't happen anymore. We might have been one of the last ones to do it, considering how things are going, you know? So no one would buy it, but we got the better deal, because we wouldn't have had this road if the financiers didn't do that. And just being able to be part of that the whole time, like, you know, it's been incredible. Like, it's beyond exceeded. Like, first the skateboarding documentary, right? I made it. Peanut Butter Falcon, now I've made it. Like, everything else is bonus. I'm playing with house money, you know? Really? So it's just like,
would you say that those two things are the pinnacle of your career so far?
I didn't think that they were going to happen. You know, like, I didn't have those expectations from, I mean, you sit there and you think like, I'm going to be the next so-and-so, but like, it's really hard. It's a really hard business. And I'd made 10 movies before that. Right. Somebody told me that if you make 10, one of them will work. Well, it took like the 11th or 12th to actually work, you know. That's a lot. Like, people can get lucky or be really good and get, you know, the cream seems to always rise to the top. You know, I feel like I know,
love that sign,
what I'm doing now. So if you keep making good shit, people will see it. If you make bad stuff, sometimes people still see it. But if you don't, or if you do, but most of the time they don't, you know? So I just want to keep making good stuff. And Peanut Butter Falcon has opened a lot of doors for me with like the opportunity to work with more great people in that sense. So I've got a lot of stuff I'm working on right now, putting together in development stages and script stages and actors attached. And, you know, we were supposed to shoot a movie last summer that got moved because of COVID. And now we're supposed to shoot it this summer. And, you know, I've got I think I look at the slate, there's like 14 things on there that I'm actively working on. So we just do a little bit with what needs it. And, you know,
that's that. But
what I was saying about it's the house money, or this is the bonus round. It is like, what do you, you know, like I just,
well, what's the end goal? Is there an end game? There's no end game, is there?
No, it's a sustainable life, making good stuff that people enjoy.
Yeah.
That I enjoy, you know?
Why do you think no one wanted to buy that movie originally?
I don't know.
You think because it was at the
time? It's hard to have an opinion publicly, you know, these days.
Saturated market?
People were scared, I think. It started a guy with Down syndrome, you know? They were afraid. And if you see the movie, it's not like a, you know, Zach is treated like a real person in that movie, you know? The Tyler character and Zach, they have a real honest relationship.
So the character, you know, the actor with Down syndrome is...
Yeah, they don't coddle him because he's got Down syndrome. Like, he's treated like as a real person. And I think maybe some of these folks were afraid of that. Like it would come across as mean, or, you know, like you should, I don't know. I think people were afraid of it.
Discriminatory? Yeah.
Maybe. Or just like afraid of it. Everyone's so afraid of any backlash,
like,
you know,
like
so.
Political correctness, you know,
maybe I don't
polarizing,
know.
Yeah. Polarizing audiences, things like that.
Yeah.
I thought that's what it was all about though, is arousing, you know, controversial topics and thoughts. Like is the character, is it representative of how the character may be treated in real life, their everyday life?
It's representative of how he should be treated in real life.
Should be treated.
But I don't think that's how, you know, people with disabilities don't get treated as normal.
Yeah.
People, you know, they get treated as, oh, hey, you know, like the children or whatever that is. It's.
Yeah. I getcha.
You know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying, yeah. Is it,
yeah,
is it like, and then you, like you said, you got these finances. I mean, was it a case of like cold calling people to finance it? Like banging on doors and.
No. We had great actors attached to it. And
they,
you know,
would you mind telling us who they are? Like, I know the lead actor.
The Shia LaBeouf was the lead, and then Dakota Johnson was in it.
Amazing.
And then, you know, and Zach, and then we had a great supporting cast, Bruce Dern and John Hawks and Yellow Wolf. And, but we, you know, see, it's one of the agencies here sent it out to the financiers, and then, you know, we had a few different offers.
Yeah.
We went with the one, and yeah, it was.
Oh, so there was multiple offers there. Okay,
there were multiple offers, but at different levels, you know.
Yeah.
So we met with everybody, and we, which is super uncommon. I think people really responded to the script and the cast. So
yeah. See, this is the side of things that like most people don't hear. Like it's definitely the less glamorous side of filmmaking. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't like all that money stuff, and I like making stuff. I like the act of making it.
Yeah.
And the result of sharing it. I don't love that side of things, but it's necessary. They're all necessary.
It's necessary, especially when you believe in it. I mean, and it sounds like there was never a point where you guys didn't believe in its value, correct?
No. Luckily, we stayed strong in that, you know?
Yeah.
Because we could have just been like, fine, just take it. You know, do that with it. You know, people get, when you get to the end of a movie, I think it's easy to be tired.
Gotcha.
And just let it go out there. However, it seems the easiest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, man, like I said, it's been amazing. It's been well over an hour, and, you know, like I just love hearing these stories. Like for me to sit back and listen to you speak like that. And I'm really just grateful for your honesty and openness around, you know, your sobriety stuff. I really believe that there'd be a lot of people out there that need to hear your experiences with that. So thank you for sharing.
Yeah, changed my life, man.
Now, listen, man. Yeah, for sure. I don't know, dude. Like, I don't know you that well. And our mutual friend connected us, which I'm super grateful for. And I don't know, bro, like through this strange computer screen, which I never really, I've always wanted to avoid remote recordings, but they're now just in it. Like they're just part of life. I have to do them, especially because it gives me access to amazing humans like you. But dude, you really, I see a very content and happy human being, man. I feel it. So thank you.
Thanks.
The other thing I just wanted to mention is, I ask all guests to come to the podcast with a cause that they want to support or advocate for. Now, I didn't actually, because we've been on a tight schedule, I didn't actually prepare you for this. No. And if you don't have a cause off the top of your head, that's okay, because I've got one that I'd like to raise awareness about. But is there any causes or that you'd like to, you know, sort of bring up or, that you support?
I mean, we were talking about Peanut Butter Falcon. You could always go to Best Buddies and one of those that we supported during that.
Okay.
What was yours?
So I'd like to just raise awareness about the organization Sungai Watch in Bali. They're doing amazing river cleanup programs. And just recently, this is led by Gary Benchnib, who is an environmental conservationist. And they just recently cleaned up the canal at Dreamland Beach. Now, you're probably like, oh, they cleaned up a canal. I think they removed something like 22 tons of debris and rubbish from this canal near one of the most beautiful beaches in Bali. And they are not only just removing the rubbish, they're taking the rubbish and the debris and they're dividing it and they're analyzing where it came from. And a lot of this debris is from the ocean, and this rubbish is from the ocean, and the rubbish has come from different parts of the world. It's not actually a lot of it's from Indonesia, but it's not from actually Bali. And this is just a really profound indicator of when we pollute our oceans that rubbish is not actually ending up in your backyard, it's ending up in other people's backyard. So if you can, you know, go to Sungai Watch and their website, it's SungaiWatch, and you can get on their website and support their cause. And even just look them up on Instagram and have a look at what they just did in the last few days. It's absolutely amazing and inspiring to see people like taking real action and making real change. So bravo, Gary and the team. Thank you. Yeah, man. So good. I'll look up Good Buddies as well.
Is it like it's Best Buddy. It's like, you know, that it's like a Big Brother thing, but with people with disabilities.
And like a mentoring program. And
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. And so I knew that was what you were
doing. I just didn't want to butcher it by making up my own mission statement, you know?
No, and I knew that's what you were getting to. So thank you. And I'll put a link to that in Lijah's show notes. And if you liked this episode, you can go to terriblehappytalks.com if you're not already. You may also enjoy episodes with Hollywood stuntman Pat Millen. There's also some back catalog episodes with Christian Stern, who was the most listened to episode. He's a profound artist from California as well. And the next thing I want to say, my brother, is I have a present for you. And I need to get your shoe size because our friends at IndoSole will be sending you a pair of flip-flops or slides made from repurposed motor vehicle tires. So thanks to IndoSole for always supporting the show. And always remember to use code THT at checkout for the discount.
Sweet.
Bro, is there anything you want to end on? Anything special with anything you want to say?
I want it. No, this is great. I love talking to you. I love meeting new people. The thing about this, what you were saying about this, the computer connection, just Zoom in general, or, you know, like I'm way hardcore into my sobriety and the meetings and the people that I have met in this last year, it's been incredible. What has happened, I don't wish death or pain upon anybody, but the stuff that it's done to change or evolve some of our communication and the ability to have meetings and the amount of time I'm not banking in a car is incredible. So
what do you mean banking? What do you mean?
The amount of time I'm banking by not being in a car. I'm sorry. Like the amount of time that I have by not driving back and forth.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. I said that wrong.
No, that's got it.
I told you my English was never like the thing. I'm just super grateful to have these kind of things, just really? Doing this with you and just having Zooms and ways to connect that are, you know, in a time that we probably couldn't if we didn't have this. It's just so important. Connection and fellowship, I've learned, is be the most important thing in my life. You know, if I didn't have that, I wouldn't be able to survive.
Oh,
you know,
dude, that's so good, man. I love that. Without that, I wouldn't be able to survive. And you know what? Same here, brother. Same here. And I love that you mentioned that. I think it is one of the most positive things to come out of this whole pandemic stuff is that, yeah, the time that we get back. Like, I know numerous friends that don't have to commute 2 hours every day to their job. So that's 2 hours they're getting every day. And you add that up over a week, that's a lot of hours, man. You know, yeah. I guess for me, I've personally struggled with, I don't feel like I'm connecting on the human level as much as I would if I was in person, whether it be doing a podcast or whether it be, you know, in a meeting. I don't know if it's as profound. Do you think it's as profound?
Well, I'll tell you, at an AA meeting, when I'm looking at 25 faces or 50 faces, I think you can do on Zoom now.
Right.
It's insane. Yeah, I think it's I'm looking in eyes. You know, I don't do that at a meeting in person. It's a different experience, but I feel the connection. You know, I feel the connection to look at, you know, 25 people's faces when I speak or when I'm listening to somebody else. And granted, I still get in the water and I surf with friends. You know, I surf with sober guys. I skate with sober guys. Amazing. Like, I'm getting that in every aspect of my life still. So yeah. It's not like one's replacing the other, but it's definitely, I think it's a hybrid now, you know? It's just like, you get the best of all the worlds.
Dude.
You got to come to our meeting.
Dude, I would love to. And I love the fact that documentary you made called Sundays about the meeting at the infamous Stoner Park, which is a skate park I've always wanted to skate. And then every Sunday you have skaters doing an AA meeting there. I'm just like, for me, that's like the dream come true. Because if I'm straight up, you know, like if I go to meetings, like, I mean, I struggle sometimes to connect, even though our fundamental story is similar. I want to be around people with like-minded interests.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that can be isolating, especially as a skateboarder, because it's not as mainstream, especially here in Australia. I know in California it seems like a bit more of a mainstream activity, but so yeah, man, get on that.
Yeah, I mean, it's taken me some years, but I feel like I got a group of friends that are like-minded now. You know, they say AA people like wouldn't normally mix. I'm like, all my dudes, we mix. Like, we would have drank in and out, and you know, have similar values and interests. So it's become a really full world of the full life of that stuff, you know?
Yeah, so. Dude. And like,
it's taking work. So,
yeah. And like, I watched that doco and I was like, they're my people. I could just tell straight away, you know? And then, Brendan Turner, you know, the pro skater, Brendan Turner, he's doing a similar thing, with the sober living that he's involved in, which is like super cool. Yeah, man.
Oh, cool.
And you're into surfing now. How long's that been?
Yeah. 3 years almost. But I do it alcoholically. banking hours.
Are you progressing?
Yeah. I mean, I surf every day.
Where are you? Venice.
Today I surf Venice. If there's waves in Venice, I'll always surf Venice just because it's convenient.
What are the waves like at Venice? Beach break?
Yeah, it's beach break. You know, it's better in the winter.
Yeah. How far were you?
Better mix.
How far were you travel? Like, where do you travel to for better waves? You get into Tres. You get
to Bali.
I mean,
yeah. I don't go to Trestles. I try to avoid the crowds. You know, just because at this it's hard to avoid crowds now. Everything's gotten so busy since last year. I think everybody started surfing. But I'll go up to, you know, there's some spots in County Line I like to go to. I'll go down to Huntington sometimes. You know, just wherever the waves are at.
Tell you what, you want to improve your
surf. Like, I'll surf a mediocre wave with no crowd before I go to a good wave. I always do that. I always choose that.
Dude, you are on it. And even I was talking to Brad Gerlach the other day, and he said the exact same thing. He's like, yeah, I'll look for the empty bank with no one on it. Lower quality, but But you want to improve your surfing, man. It just, if you surf a week of perfect waves, like go on a surf trip to the Mentawai Islands, and in a week, you'll improve your surfing there in 1 week than you would in, say, 6 months surfing like a closeout beach break. Just like perfect waves.
I went to Costa Rica over Christmas.
What's that like?
And for 2 weeks. It was insane. Yeah, surfed the same beach break every day, but it was so good. Like, yeah. I definitely improved my surfing every day, you know.
Crush Organics makes the best CBD oils and topicals. Go to crushorganics.com, that's crushorganics.com, and use code THT to get that epic 40% discount. It makes a huge difference. I advocate for CBD products because they've done so much for me physically and mentally. So really helps me post-exercise with recovery, and it's also done loads for me in terms of getting me in really good sleep patterns and also reducing feelings of anxiety. So get on crushorganics.com. Indosol Footwear have been a long-time supporter of THT. They make footwear like sandals, flip-flops, slides from repurposed motor vehicle tires. So tires that would usually go into landfill, Indosol get them, and they process them down and turn them into footwear that looks awesome. They're a B Corp certified company, which is the same company that Patagonia is certified by. And actually, Patagonia created that certification. So they do everything fair trade and ethically. They're a rad company, and I'm so stoked to be affiliated with them. So use code THT at Indosol.com. That's Indosole.com. Use the code THT, get the 15% discount, support THT, and support conscious consumerism.